Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is our favorite, Blair Horner, Legislative Director for the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Welcome, Blair. I have to say, in welcoming you, that I remember when NYPIRG, my image of NYPIRG was one college student, unshaven, sitting under a light bulb, doing things with his hands. The point really is
this
is
we still have light bulbs.
You're a college student. This organization really is the sort of conscience of New York State.
Thank you. I'm not sure if I'm being damned with faint praise, though.
No. I think you've really brought that. You guys have really done an amazing job with this organization. Amazing.
Well, it's been it's great fun. I mean, I've been with NYPIRG except for a couple of stints with since 1979.
Didn't so you go to work time. For Attorney General Andrew Cuomo?
Then Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. I did a year plus as the special advisor. My primary mission was to create something called Project Sunlight, which is now called, I think, Open Government. On the Attorney General's website.
Which is so interesting because I'm now reading this magnificent biography of Cuomo by Michael Schneerson called The Contender. And in it, Schneerson makes the point that if there's one thing that you could not say about Andrew is that he's transparent or that he has set anything up resembling transparency, has gone the other way. And how does that make you feel, having really come aboard, being the great guy you are and committed to open government, and to see what's become of all of this?
Well, I get involved in these projects clear-eyed about what's going to happen. The Project Sunlight project did happen, and there were no restrictions on my activities. I did whatever. I had a long leash. All I had to do was implement sort of the vision as the then Attorney General wanted it to happen. And so the public now can go and take a look at it and take a look at campaign contributions, bill introductions, government contracts, charities, connections, all in one handy-dandy little place. So that was fun. It was a fun project. I got to work with good people. It was a good thing. I have no complaints having worked at the Attorney General's office. I thought I was treated very well. And the project got done like it was supposed to. So that, you know, that's what's supposed to happen, right? In a democracy, that citizens, when tapped to do something, should volunteer and go do it. Well, in this case, I didn't even volunteer. I actually got paid pretty well, far better than I get paid at NYPIRG.
So when you got there, this book makes a great thing about micromanagement by the then Attorney General, now Governor, that, you know, he wants to make every decision about the color on the walls. Did you have any experiences like that?
No, not really. I mean, on this particular project, again, I can't speak to what was happening writ large in the Attorney General's office. And I always had the sense from being on the executive staff that the governor was definitely a hands-on manager and drove the staff hard. But I thought that was a good thing. I think taxpayers want government to be working very hard and to be held to account. So no, all that side of it was fine. In terms of the project, obviously, I did show him mock-ups as every step of the way. It was his project. He was the elected official that ran the agency. And certainly he had feedback, constructive feedback. And we ended up with a product that I thought was pretty good for getting it out the door in 1 year.
In Schneerson's book, there is a sense that he can get angry at somebody, even if that somebody is a friend and who he owes tremendous favors to, but any perceived slight, any perceived thing that you didn't jump fast enough or you were somewhere, years ago, you supported a different candidate he didn't like, you know, you were dog meat.
My guess is that if all that's true, and I have no reason to doubt it, but I mean, if all that's true, then the governor would not be unique in American politics in terms of holding a grudge forever. I have elected officials that are still mad at me for something that supposedly I did in 1980-something.
Yeah.
So again, it's not unique. But when I was at the Attorney General's office, I never certainly experienced or observed anything that was, you know, out of the ordinary or inappropriate. When we were in executive staff meetings, again, I don't want to talk out of school too much, but if people didn't have their act together, You could feel the tension in the room, but it was never inappropriate. If people didn't have their act together, that's what I want to know. In fact, is that the top-ranking official at some agency wants people to be held to account and to deliver on what they're supposed to do, and that's all I ever felt. What was happening, at least in one of my experiences when I was at the Attorney General's office.
Now, Blair Horner, since you've been out of there, you have not been loath to criticize the governor when you think it's appropriate. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, right away, he, in January of 2011, created something, the Committee to Save New York.
Actually, dark music, please.
Exactly. I shouldn't say that he created it. I don't think he would agree with that. But certainly it was magically created simultaneously with the governor becoming governor and advanced the governor's agenda. And it was
so a lot of people putting money into it, and they were putting ads on how great the governor was, real estate interests and all the
real estate interests, hedge fund folks, big money guys, basically from downstate. Pumping money into something called the Committee to Save New York, which had not existed, now existed. And for the first 2 years of the governor being governor, two plus years, probably outspent any other lobbying group in New York State. And at the time, in January, they were saying, well, we're not even going to report that we're lobbying, even though it was pretty clear on its face what it was doing. And so we challenged that.
Blair, yeah, but Blair Horner in Schneerson's book is seen as the guy who challenged it.
I was the lead person at NYPIRG that challenged it, and we got into a fight about it right away. So, I mean,
you and him?
Well, NYPIRG and the administration did not see eye to eye on that, and certainly not the Committee to Save New York, which ultimately, just as a postscript, did report its lobbying activities as required under the law.
But they were wrapped on the knuckles and told they had to by the lobbying
Yes. Okay. Yes. We filed a complaint, an official complaint against them.
It's not that one day they woke up and said, oh, by the way, we think you
forgot.
Have a point.
Right. Yeah. No, they didn't say, oh, we forgot. So that was January of 2011. So that was the first month. And so we were out of the blocks on our normally good footing that we have with governors going back all the years that I've been at NYPIRG. Governor Patterson, we filed a complaint on the Yankee tickets, and he ultimately had to pay a $60,000 fine for lying under oath.
For a couple of Yankee tickets he got, he said they gave it to him, but in fact,
Under the law, you're not allowed to. Public officials are not allowed to accept gifts from lobbying entities. Yankees are a lobbying entity in New York State under the law. Governor Spitzer wasn't happy with us. Governor Pataki wasn't happy with us. And Governor Mario Cuomo wasn't happy with us. So, you know, it's sort of like Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, right? It doesn't matter who the governor is. It's still Wile E. Coyote, and I'm the one who gets hit with the anvil.
Well, but the point of this book that's so interesting is the very complicated relationship between Mario Cuomo and Andrew Cuomo. And one of the things that's so interesting about it is that while they competed, while they didn't always like what each other were doing and advice, there were those moments where anybody who was perceived as being the slightest bit mean to Mario were going to get it in the neck. Did you experience any of that?
No. I mean, you know, again, I don't know. I mean, Schneerson obviously did a tremendous amount of research.
Very good book.
Talked to tons of people. I haven't read the book. You know, I've seen the cover. But I haven't read it, so it's hard for me to comment on somebody else's book. But in terms of our institutional interactions with both former Governor Cuomo and current Governor Cuomo, the only times they were respectively mad at us was really on policy differences. We're not a partisan organization. It's not our business to determine who gets elected governor. It's whoever the governor is. They do things that we agree with. We say that that's great. They do things we don't agree with. We say that that's lousy. And we try to duke it out as much as we can. So I didn't feel any. Then Attorney General Andrew Cuomo hired me, and that was well after Governor Mario Cuomo had been governor. So I never felt any sort of repercussions or anything like that.
I'm seeing that Jill Stein. Now, most of our listeners don't know who she is, but she runs perpetually for political office, and she's to the left of center, and generally is a third-party candidate. She doesn't do that well, but, you know, people who are really sick and tired of the Republicrats might vote for her.
Demo-plublicans.
She's talking about oil train bombs, basically. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a complicated issue. I mean, if you're going to allow oil drilling in the Dakotas, in the Bakken region, and then want to ship the oil out, it's either going to have to go through pipelines or trains. Right now, it's basically going via train, and some of those trains roll through Albany. the sort of the regulation of both the containers themselves and the way that the oil is extracted make them highly flammable. And so the arguments being made that these, that calling them bomb trains, of course, I mean, you know, that's sort of pejorative, I guess, we could, to say that they are extremely, they should be dealt with extremely carefully. I think I would agree with that. And the federal government and the states should do everything humanly possible to make sure that this stuff is as safe as possible if you're going to allow it going forward. Now, there's a larger question, which is, why is the United States going crazy allowing drilling of fossil fuels generally when the planet is heating up and we are experiencing climate change that stems from human activity, largely due to the burning of fossil fuels? It seems like the public policies are all on their head, right? We should be using whatever investments we have into coming up with power production that's generated by non-fossil fuels. So again, there's this larger sort of issue about climate change generally. This is a more narrow issue about if you're going to allow the kind of drilling and then transporting it around, should you be doing it in a way that is more hazardous or less hazardous? Right now, they're allowing things to be more hazardous, not less hazardous.
I want to switch topics for a second and tell you that New York State Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie emerged after Speaker Silver was gone. And he says that he's for ethics and integrity, and he's going to focus on that. Has he been true to his word?
Well, I mean, he's only been speaker for 2 months, right? So, you know, time...
2 months can be an eternity.
It can be an eternity.
Especially around budget time.
Right. The focus, though, for his job, you know, he gets parachuted in as speaker. He's not prepared for it. He sort of has to, you know, it's like building the plane while you're flying it. And the focus, in his case, I think has been rightly focused on the budget. But ethics was a big priority of the budget discussions, largely due to the governor's insistence that it be done so. It was really the legislature that didn't want to do anything and the governor who wanted to do something. Now, our problem with the way the ethics stuff played out is that the governor planted the ethics goalposts on the 30-yard line as compared to the goal line. And instead of saying, well, if the problem of outside income for lawmakers is something you deal with like Congress does by limiting outside income, because the problem, alleged problem with Speaker Silver was he was making millions of dollars in his outside job, and he was basically doing it because of his inside job, and that's a conflict of interest. The governor, instead of saying, well, we're going to limit that, says, well, we're going to disclose total disclosure, which never made any sense to me. And then at the end of the day, when the legislature and the governor agreed to more ethics disclosures as part of the budget, it's really more loophole than law. So I don't know how Speaker Hastie sort of matches up on this. The assembly was not out in front.
Well, he and just to interrupt for a second, he and the governor, when they announced this ethics reform, they told us we had ethics reform, but they forgot to tell us what was in it at the
very
beginning.
They gave us a press release.
And then they sort of stood up Rocky style, you know, and said, you know, we won. We got ethics reform. Yeah. Turns out it's a bunch of BS.
Well, I mean, there was the sort of the budgetary kabuki dance on this was the governor and the speaker sort of come out with a press release. There's no bill language, but they have an agreement. The assembly says, the Senate then says, oh, no, we don't like that. But again, there's no language.
We don't know what they don't like.
Exactly. And nobody knows anything. They're all just sort of posturing. And at the end of the day, bill language emerges at 1:30 p.m. on March 31st.
But not the end of that first day when they announced ethics reform. Of the day, in other words, the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, they just jammed it through. There was no public comments at all. And it's an ethics proposal. And so it's classic Albany. It goes back to your Schnerrman comments. Classic Albany, that the proposal to open up government and make it more accountable is hammered out in secret and then jammed through with no real meaningful opportunity for even the lawmakers to read what's in it. So it was really a horrible process. And as a result, you know, you get at best a mediocre product, at worst, a complete opportunity missed.
But into all of this, riding on a white horse comes Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general, who Schneerson, not Schneiderman, tells us.
Very confusing. Yeah, we have to have a scorecard
here. In his new book, The Contender, tells us is a historic enemy of the governor. The governor isn't his enemy, at least from the beginning. He's the governor's enemy, and the governor has perceived slights from him that he doesn't like. And so he comes out with a plan, much like the U.S. Congress. No outside income.
Right.
good plan, I thought, not even considered.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's to be honest, it's hard for any attorney general to get any legislation considered because they're usually viewed as a potential electoral threat to the governor.
Exactly. And some people think that's exactly why he had the guts to do it, because he's saying, here I am, Andrew, go somewhere else, I'll be there.
It certainly jammed the governor. There's no doubt about it. It surprised everyone because up until that point, the attorney general had been, as far as I could ever tell, certainly from a public view at a distance,
docile.
Yes, cooperative with the governor, and certainly not being a thorn in his side. By sort of pushing the envelope on ethics and coming out with a proposal where he knew the governor not only could not go, but doesn't even want to go, I thought sort of jammed the governor a little bit in these negotiations, not a little bit, a lot. And I'm sure there'll be some sort of political infighting that followed. And I thought it was helpful that the attorney general put out the proposal because it sort of
framed
what is the appropriate solution to this vexing problem, which is how do you allow public officials to have outside jobs without there being a potential conflict of interest? And it's not just Silver that's had this problem. There's a guy named Bruno that had the same kind of problem with outside occupation. Guys named Seminario, Valella, Libel. I mean, the list goes on. The hits go on in terms of people using their public office for private gain. The best way to deal with it is what the Congress did. And or to eliminate it altogether. That wasn't even the governor made that speech at the New York University. He made the speech, New York University Law School, that saying that the appropriate response, the best solution is to end the conflict. And then in the speech does a U-turn and says, well, after I just said it's not a great idea to regulate it, my proposal is to regulate it and disclose it. It was sort of
that
like,
is so Andrew.
Well, it was definitely a zigzag. One old politician once argued to me that, you know, in politics, you have to adopt the swerve theory. He said it's like driving in Manhattan. If you swerve back and forth, everyone gives you the right of way. It's when the people who drive right down the middle of the road, they get into problems in traffic in Manhattan. And in politics, he said to me, this old guy, now this was early on in my career, you have to have the swerve. He actually was from the downstate. So a swerve theory where you had to sort of make people wary of you on both the left and the right. So the governor not only swerved, he did a U-turn.
So you mentioned Speaker Silver. I wanted to ask you about this. I've been talking to some of the old hands who watch this kind of thing, and they're saying that even though he was indicted by Preet Bharara and called out, that the fact pattern in this particular case is much more dubious than the one that they even had with Joe Bruno. So that there are the old hands maybe wishfully thinking that the speaker, the former speaker, Silver, is going to get off.
Well, I mean, you never know. I mean, he is innocent until proven guilty, and that's fair as fair. It was the same thing with Senator Bruno. But what is sort of different, I think, in this case is they have they flipped some people who have gone state's evidence who were close with the speaker. Nothing like that, really. I mean, Abruzzese, to some extent.
That was in the Bruno case, yeah.
But in this case, other people have sort of flipped. They have what appears to be, you know, clear evidence, perhaps from a wiretap of information. So, you don't know. I mean, what the allegation is that the speaker used as speaker was driving state resources to a particular researcher, a physician researcher, who it turns out is the nation's expert in mesothelioma.
Seems like a real nice guy. It's too bad it happens to him.
And that deal was that he would then send the cases that he was treating, which seemed the most appropriate for legal action, to Silver, who would then send it on to the Weitz and Luxembourg firm. That was one allegation. The other was that he, the speaker, which I think is a violation, had a separate law firm that he was involved in that was doing real estate work with what has been reported to be a guy named Leonard Litwin, who's a very prominent developer in Manhattan. And there was a whole series of sort of interlocking decisions and sweetheart deals in terms of tax credits and public benefits that were benefiting Litwin. Now, both of those are,
but let me
whether
just
or not
get
they're
that,
illegal,
yeah,
we
yeah,
don't
but
know
let me get
yet,
that straight.
Right?
The second law firm was not listed by Silver on his disclosure.
That's right.
And that's, is that a felony? Is it a misdemeanor or is it a nothing?
Well, it may, you know, we'll have to see what he says, right? Yeah. I mean, the JCOPE has filed, as a result of that, the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, the state watchdog, has filed.
Which is pretty well known to be controlled by Cuomo.
Well, it is certainly not viewed as sufficiently independent, has filed and said that they have argued that the speaker violated the state's ethics laws by not filing that information. I think the speaker is going to have some sort of argument for that. I mean, when you look at his filings over time, they list Weitz and Luxembourg and nothing else.
Right.
And then somewhere around 2011, 2010, his filings start saying things like, when it says the reason for why he made the money, legal work including Weitz and Luxembourg.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that was sort of like a technical way, I think a tip of the hat to say that there was some other way that I was making money. Now, under the law, you're supposed to list it, though, and he clearly does not list the second firm. You know, how that plays out, I mean, it could just be a fine, depending on, you know, what sort of argument that the speaker makes. But I think that's the least of his worries. When you have the U.S. Attorney's Office breathing down your neck, that's what you focus on, because that could mean pounding rocks as compared to writing a check. So we'll see what happens. I mean, the speaker, you know, the former speaker, you know, certainly has a case to be made. And again, for all the listeners, we should never forget these individuals are innocent until proven guilty. But I think what makes the difference in our original question on the Silver Bruno cases is that in the Silver case, there are people that have been flipped to state's evidence who apparently were very deeply involved in both of these activities. So we'll see.
Blair, the governor came in saying he was going to clean up Albany. We only have a minute. Has he?
The governor should not close the broom closet. He should continue to work by getting the mop out and using another, you know, round of detergent in the mop bucket and get back to work. No, it's not done. The work is not done. I mean, to be fair, you know, democracy is always a work in progress, and democracy is all about process. And so there will always be issues. But I think that the governor has not made sort of the ethical reform of Albany a top priority of his. It has been certainly.
Well, he said he did.
Well, I would think that he has made it a priority, but not the top.
Well, if he's going to clean up Albany, I have a question for you. Should he take a bath?
Not in the mop bucket. That's too gross. Like in the budget, for example, I think he was all in, really. He was really focused on trying to deal with the teacher issues in the education side of the budget, and he's willing to sacrifice issues on the ethics side to get what he really wanted. And I think that's often what you see with the governor, that in the sort of negotiation triage that inevitably follows policy decisions, he's willing to sacrifice reforms for some other element of his agenda.
Well, Blair Horner, always great to talk to you. You put up with me, and I appreciate it so much. I try my best, and you always outdo me. We're out of time. Our guest has been Blair Horner, legislative director for NYPIRG, one of the great good guys in Albany. Thanks so much for joining us, Blair, and we hope to see you back here real soon.
Anytime.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.